Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you. As the previous speaker said, I'm certainly a voice and face from the past of international criminal justice, but I think I probably have got a few comments that are worthwhile to make about the future. Certainly, first and foremost, thank you very much indeed to all of the organisers for inviting me to participate in this interesting project. I have to make one comment at the beginning because of my function, that any comments that I make are my own, and I'm not here speaking in an official capacity on behalf of Her Majesty's government, who has many other more pressing matters to think about, I think, at the moment. We are all quite rightly only given 15 minutes to speak today, and I've got to make every second count. Professor Bergsmo has kindly asked me to cover off my own successes and failures of nearly a quarter of a century in international criminal law and relate that to this process of preliminary examination. I say that in good humour to an old friend and colleague, but it's remarkable standing here today how far and how fast we have come in this field of law in less than a single generation. So with that, I'll address you briefly on three interconnected strands. First, my experiences at the Yugoslav Tribunal, and in fact, the lack of real effective and independent scrutiny applied to investigations brought into the jurisdiction of the court. In this first strand, I'll also have something to say about my time at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, as related to this process of preliminary examinations. Secondly, I'll speak to you about the preliminary examination in relation to the UK by the ICC in respect of allegations against UK forces in Iraq, reminding you all that this is an ongoing legal process, so I've got to be very careful what I say about that. And lastly, my role as the Director of Service Prosecutions in the United Kingdom, the Civilian Chief Military Prosecutor, and the domestic investigations and prosecutions of allegations of operational offending in Iraq. So the complementary aspect to what the ICC is doing with its preliminary examination. So I can here demonstrate to you positive complementarity at work. I wanted to actually, very briefly, I know I've only got 50 minutes, to reiterate what Morten Bergsmo said about teams and people being able to speak freely and independence of thought. I absolutely agree with him. It's fundamental, whatever prescriptive measures you put in place, unless people can speak freely, and unless people like me as chief prosecutors can be constantly challenged, you will never improve the quality of things. But I will come back to that. But I fully endorse what you're saying, Morten. I fully endorse it. So what do we mean by this word preliminary examination? Well, as we know, it means something very specific at the International Criminal Court. And it's a process which is principally governed, as you know, by Article 53 of the statute. There's also a very detailed, in fact, an excellent policy paper by the ICC from November of 2013. But of course, at the ICTY and at the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, and indeed in domestic jurisdictions everywhere, prosecutors, investigative judges, policemen are constantly engaging in these preliminary deliberations about investigations and cases. So my first strand, the ICTY. Recall that at the Yugoslav Tribunal, the prosecutor simply commenced an investigation. If you look at the ICTY rules, and it's Part 4, Section 1, they only address how an investigation should be conducted. There's nothing on the legal and evidential considerations applicable to the opening of an investigation. So immense discretion vested in one individual and no judicial oversight of that decision at all. Certainly in the early days, so back in the mid-90s, I recall very little structured discussion about jurisdiction, gravity, complementarity, and the interests of justice when it was decided to open an investigation. In saying that, I don't detach myself from these discussions. I was part of it all. And I also know how desperate we all were to get this fragile and fledgling institution off the ground and get into the courtroom. But this significant discretion vested in the prosecutor led to later challenges for many of us. We know, in some very limited instances at the ICTY, investigations and prosecutions were influenced and driven primarily by political considerations, and led in one particular case to an acquittal at trial, and then a subsequent and humiliating acquittal at a retrial. That damaged the reputation of a court which otherwise had developed and maintained a very solid reputation, which it does now. I've spoken publicly about that particular case. We can certainly discuss it later. Also, the transition from investigation to charges and potential prosecutions was a very, very brief and not entirely satisfactory process at the ICTY. It's Rule 47 of the Rules of Procedure and Evidence, and it's Article 1 of the statute. The prosecutor simply had to be satisfied that there were sufficient grounds to there was sufficient evidence to provide reasonable grounds for believing a suspect had committed a crime within the jurisdiction of the court. An indictment was prepared and sent to a judge with a very limited bundle of evidence, who applied the same evidential standard. The judge then confirmed or dismissed each count in the indictment, asked for additional evidence, or adjourned the proceedings to allow modification of the indictment. In my experience, I recall two instances where a judge asked for more evidence over a 10-year period. There may be other examples from other people in the room, but that's my recollection. Confirming at this low evidential standard of reasonable grounds to believe means if your accused is arrested the day after your indictment is confirmed, you find yourself going to trial with a case that you may not be able to prove beyond reasonable doubt. Now, this is not something theoretical. This happened, and it happened to me as a young lawyer at the court. This is what happened in the Blaszczyk case, where he was charged in November of 1995, and with no expectation of arrest, He then voluntarily surrendered to the court in April of 1996. Nightmare. In 12 days' time, it will be the 20th anniversary of the beginning of the General Blaszczyk trial at the ICTY. I was a young junior on that case. Charges had been confirmed with limited evidence, and then between confirmation and arrest of the accused, not much had been done to improve matters. While I acknowledge my fair share of responsibility for the trial work in that case, I was not involved in the confirmation of it. So in essence, we went to trial having to investigate and prosecute at the same time for two long years. It felt like 20. Mark Harmon, who led me in that case, in his typical stoical fashion, described it thus. He said it was like putting together the millions of pieces of a jumbo jet while at the same time to pilot it blind across the Atlantic. What does not kill you makes you stronger, ladies and gentlemen. But it is a case which demonstrates profoundly the need for early and intense scrutiny if you're looking to investigate and prosecute these very serious cases. A little bit on the ECCC, the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, where I was the co-prosecutor, the international co-prosecutor for 4 years. This was a court that was never meant to blend the major legal systems of the world, although I confess the trials and the appeals were distinctly adversarial in character, and that was probably because of so many of the Anglo-Saxon lawyers like myself that were there. While the co-prosecutors could initiate prosecutions based on his or her own discretion or where a complaint had been received, they were only entitled to carry out preliminary investigations, which was a very limited investigation. And where they had the legal standard was where they had reasons to believe a crime had been committed, then they could transmit an introductory submission to the co-investigating judges requesting the opening of a judicial investigation. Arguably, that's a similar evidential standard that triggered the charging and arrest of an accused at the ICTY, but only justified the opening of a judicial investigation at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, which is pretty shocking, actually, when you think about it. Now, I acknowledged in my opening statement in case two at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal that the court suffered under its own burdens, and I think we probably all know what those were. I'm not going to express what they are because proceedings are still ongoing and often end up being quoted in people's written filings if I say anything publicly. But I always believed that the legal architecture of that court was well set up for these very, very serious investigations. I do think, even as a Brit, that the civil law really does lend itself very well, mainly because the powers of the prosecution are very limited in the early stages. Judges investigated the allegations, and the defence and the prosecution could participate in the investigation. So they had a lot less reason to complain in the trial because they were able to make requests of the judges during the investigation. You need to look at this, you need to look at that. Now, wasn't always granted, of course, but the right was there. So lots of checks and balances. Now, that court was not completely effective for many reasons, but I think the legal architecture was very, very sound. To my second topic, the ICC preliminary examination of allegations against UK forces in Iraq. Briefly reminding you of the detail. Coalition forces, of which the UK was a part, entered Iraq in March 2003. Combat operations ended in May 2003, and then followed a period of occupation until 28 June 2004, with UK forces responsible for security and supporting the civilian administration in Basra. UK forces stayed another 5 years, supporting the Iraqi authorities until 2009. Iraq Historic Allegations Team, which I refer to as IHAT, was set up in 2010 by the UK government to address allegations by Iraqi civilians of mistreatment and unlawful killings by UK forces. Prior to 2010, UK forces were not unpoliced. They were policed by the military police, but for a variety of reasons I don't have the time to go into now, the British courts, the English courts, decided that they should be taken out and that the investigation should be conducted by the civilian police, with my organisation, the Service Prosecuting Authority, advising the police and, if necessary, bringing prosecutions. There was a preliminary examination by the ICC in 2006, which, against the UK, Iraq, in respect of the similar allegations. That was closed in 2006 for lack of evidence in respect of some of the allegations, and then in respect of willful killing, allegations of willful killing and inhuman treatment, it was closed because the gravity threshold was not met. Interestingly, I was working at the ICC at the time. I was aware of these allegations and the preliminary examination, not the detail. I was working on another case that's already been mentioned, the Darfur case. Now, when you read the letter from the prosecutor in February 2006, which actually closed the preliminary examination, this was addressed to the complainants, it's actually very precise in its analysis. Even though the main complaints fell away because the gravity requirement was not met, it still looked at complementarity. So it still got to that stage, and it analysed the proceedings that were being conducted in the UK to address these crimes, therefore reassuring the complainants, look, we're not looking at it because it's not serious enough, but the UK is in fact dealing with it. Now, in May 2014, the ICC reopened the preliminary examination against us. After further submissions were made by the European Centre for Constitutional and Human Rights and a now defunct law firm called Public Interest Lawyers, run by a man called Mr. Phil Shiner. There have been three reports on the ICC's work on the Iraq P, and I'll say, honestly, a lot of care goes into the analysis. I know we're here to try and improve matters, but my experience has been very positive. They've been on several missions to the UK to speak with both those making the submissions of complaint and with the UK authorities, including the investigative authorities. They've spoken at length with me. We all feel in the UK it's being very fairly done, that those conducting this analysis are doing it very fairly, listening to all the parties. If you look at the yearly reports and their activities, they do study all of the material that's provided to them, and they're very much interested in the credibility of the allegations, which has now become a critical issue for us domestically. I'll come to that in a moment. Of course, the quality of a preliminary examination for the ICC rests very much on the level of cooperation that it gets from the parties. If you don't cooperate with the ICC, the quality of the preliminary examination can't be that good. But if you look at this process as a filter where the parties cooperate with the court and where the court has access to all of the information that it needs, I think, broadly speaking, it works. Of course, I accept in those instances where there is a lack of cooperation by one or both parties or by multiple parties, where it's difficult to access information or evidence, then it becomes much more difficult and a much less informative and effective process. So my last strand is my work as the Director of Service Prosecutions in dealing with domestic investigations and prosecutions in respect of these allegations in Iraq. Now, they've been investigated since 2004, so it's been going on a very long time, 13 years, long prior to my commencement of duties as the director. The reality is that almost all of the alleged unlawful killing has fallen away for a whole variety of reasons, but we're still looking at a handful of cases out of extreme caution. In respect of allegations of abuse of individuals in UK custody, again, a number of these cases have fallen away, mostly as a result of lack of evidence or lack of credibility of the complaint. Again, I have a number of cases that I'm still looking at where the evidence is stronger and where issues of credibility do not arise, and we're still looking at them in some detail. We do have a domestic preliminary examination process ourselves. I set this up with my colleagues in IHAT, where essentially we prioritise the most serious allegations. Analysts and police officers work together with lawyers, piecing together what evidence exists and what we can obtain relatively easily, bearing in mind that a lot of the material for this is in Iraq. Obviously, some of it's also in the UK in terms of military records. It's called the Joint Case Review Panel. I think it's a very effective process. If we find that a matter is not criminal, or it will be almost impossible to obtain sufficient evidence to put together a plausible case that can be prosecuted, no further steps are taken. On the contrary, if an investigation looks like it does involve criminal conduct and reasonable and proportionate steps can be taken to move the investigation forward, then that is what is jointly decided. As you probably know, there has been intense scrutiny of these historic cases by the media, by the UK courts, by the European Court of Human Rights, by the UK Parliament, and the Parliamentary Defence Subcommittee, who wrote a very critical report in February of this year, such that the investigative arm of all of this work in the UK has had to be rapidly modified to meet the committee's concerns. These cases have not been popular in my country, where our armed forces are deeply respected and where many lost their lives in Afghanistan and Iraq or suffered catastrophic injuries. I've in fact had to remove my email address from my chamber's address because I've received a number of hate mails and threats, not from the government, but from misinformed members of the public and former members of the armed services. We're not helped by the fact that the principal lawyer who brought the complaint and the bulk of the allegations, Mr. Shiner, was disbarred in February of this year for dishonesty in relation to these Iraq cases. Solid evidence was presented before the solicitors, the lawyers' disciplinary tribunal, that witnesses have been paid to provide evidence in respect of allegations. So we're left in a situation where people were paid money and lied, and people who may well have been speaking the truth were also paid money. So it's a toxic situation that we're in now. So to be honest, for me, the preliminary examination of the ICC has been a handrail. It's been a handrail for me as a domestic chief prosecutor, which I've relied on to make my case to officials that this work has got to be done, it's got to be done comprehensively, and it's got to be done properly and in a reasonable period of time. So, finally, if I may finish, Ambassador, I think I'm probably at the limits of my time. What's the worth of all I've said? I'm sorry I had to rush. I don't normally write notes to do these, but it's the only way to get it done in less than 15 minutes. I think what I can say from all I've said is there is a need for a detailed legal framework and a set of principles for preliminary examinations. And you can see the consequences when you don't have those, when there are none at all. Of course, in the end, it's how the framework is used and how those principles are applied which really matters. And that's the challenge, and it comes back to what Morten Bergsmo said about people being able to speak freely and honestly, trying to be consistent, trying to exclude factors which should not be considered for the purposes of these preliminary examinations, trying to be just and trying to be fair. And these last issues affect all of us, both at the domestic and the international level. And while you hope that you're making the right decisions, you constantly struggle with these things. And no matter how prescriptive you make the legal framework and the principles around these preliminary examinations, in the end, it's about the exercise of discretion, which one hopes that we all follow under the law and with good conscience. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.